chapter 4, the keys of this blood. For most of the 20th century, the papacy remained in a sorry position to fulfill its prophetic role. Caught between the overwhelming ideologies of the Marxist East and the capitalist West, the Vatican hovered on the sidelines, a minor player amid the hardball geopolitics of the nation-states. It meddled when and where it could, and exerted influence hither and yon, but in a world where SAC bombers, cruise missiles, and MiGs ruled the heavens, the Vatican could do only so much on Earth. Joseph Stalin best expressed the relative impotency of the papacy when he mocked, "How many divisions does the Pope have?" None, which was why until recently it was hard to imagine how the Vatican could ever fulfill its end-time role. Not until 1929, for example, did the papacy even ever regain the sovereignty over the 108.7 acres of Vatican City, and only then after Pius XI signed the Lateran Treaty, recognizing the fascist government of Benito Mussolini. That hardly sounds like the great power depicted in Revelation and the Great Controversy. After World War II, the world divided into two hostile camps, one overtly hostile to Roman Catholicism. The Pope could do nothing as half of Europe was swallowed up by militant atheistic communism. How much power did the papacy wield when, in former staunchly Catholic countries, its members were persecuted, its jails closed, and its priests jailed, even killed? The Pope, who claimed to be the vicar of Christ on earth, wasn't allowed to visit even much of his own native continent. Across the Atlantic, Protestant America, for years fiercely anti-Catholic, was becoming a gigantic political, economic, and military power. Anti-Catholicism had been so rooted in the American psyche that it was even reflected in the Declaration of Independence. As late as 1966, when Pope Paul VI spoke at the United Nations, then-President Lyndon Johnson visited the Pontiff at his hotel. Had St. Peter's successor come to the White House, there would have been an unholy uproar. Again, this hardly sounds like the world power depicted in Revelation. Meanwhile, the United States and the Soviet Union, each amassing nuclear and conventional arsenals, faced off in a Cold War while Rome sat helplessly crunched between them. But then European and Soviet communism went belly up, and Pope John Paul II, more than any other man, was credited with turning them on their backs. With so much credit to the Pope for the monumental events that have created the post-Cold War New World Order, no wonder the papacy now occupies a powerful position in it. And nowhere is the sudden rise of the papacy more graphically explained than in Malachi Martin's 1990 hardcover, The Keys of This Blood. From the earliest pages, Malachi Martin states that John Paul was hurling the papacy into the arena of international politics as it hadn't experienced since the Dark Ages. It was, Martin wrote, the first distinguishing mark of John Paul's career as pontiff that he had thrown off the straitjacket of papal inactivity in world affairs. Martin said, too, that John Paul, quote, had served notice that he intended to take up and effectively exercise once more the international role that had been central to the tradition of Rome and to the very mandate Catholics maintained was conferred by Christ upon Peter and upon each of his successors. Early in John Paul's pontificate, commentators saw the trend. In 1980, The Atlantic said that John Paul has without a doubt returned the Vatican to the center of the international stage. In 1979, Catholic columnist George Will wrote that, in the last quarter of this secularizing century, the world's most galvanizing man works at an altar. Today, power is associated with prosaic men governing great states, all of whom must envy the power of the poet whose state is a Rome neighborhood. According to Martin, the Pope sees himself not as one world leader among many, but as one who, by virtue of his position, should be the preeminent world religious and political authority. That authority, wrote Martin, that strength is symbolized in the keys of Peter, washed in the blood of the God-man Jesus Christ. John Paul is and will be the sole possessor of the keys of this blood on that day. Close quote. What day? The day when John Paul assumes the political supremacy that he believes his office entitles him to. For in the final analysis, wrote Martin, John Paul II, as claimant vicar of Christ, does claim to be the ultimate court of judgment on society of states as a society. According to Martin, the essence of John Paul's New World Order is that neither oppressive Marxism with its godless ideology nor materialistic capitalism with its financial inequities are acceptable, and both must go. The primary difficulty for Pope John Paul II in both these models for the New World Order, wrote Martin, is that neither of them is rooted in the moral laws and human behavior revealed by God through the teachings of Christ as proposed by Christ's Church, i.e., the Roman Catholic Church. In his first social encyclical, Centesimus Annus, since the collapse of Eastern European communism, the Pope stated problems with both systems. The historical experience of the West, he wrote, shows that even if the Marxist analysis and its foundations of alienation are false, nevertheless alienation and the loss of the authentic meaning of life is a reality in Western societies too. This happens in consumerism, when people are ensnared in a web of false and superficial gratification rather than being helped to experience their personhood in an authentic and concrete way. Close quote. He also stressed the need for Sunday laws in this encyclical. One may ask whether the existing laws and the practice of industrialized society effectively ensures in our own day the exercise of this basic right to Sunday rest. Close quote. Writing cyclicals, of course, doesn't make you a world power. Now, though, with the end of European and Soviet communism, with the present instability in international finance, with the moral decline of the West, the world, linked by massive communication facilities, is heading in a direction that could grant such an internationally revered figure as John Paul, or a successor, the unparalleled political authority he's expending all the powers of his pontificate to get. Ultimately, according to Revelation 13:1-3, something to that effect must happen. The composite beast of Revelation 13, the papacy, receives a wound, but that wound, however, is not permanent. And this beast and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. For 1,500 years or more, wrote Martin, Rome has kept a strong hand as possible in each local community around the world. By and large, in admitting some exceptions, that had been the Roman view until the 200 years of inactivity had been imposed upon the papacy by the major secular powers of the world. Close quote. 200 years of inactivity imposed upon the papacy by the major secular powers of the world? 200 years ago was the 1790s. Adventists have dated the deadly wound given to Rome, Revelation 13:3, at the end of the time and dividing of time of Daniel 7:25. They have placed it in 1798 when French General Berthier took the Pope captive, or about 200 years ago. Ellen White, in The Great Controversy, warned that, quote, the Roman Church is far-reaching in her plans and modes of operation. She is employing every device to extend her influence and increase her power in preparation for a fierce and determined conflict to regain control of the world. Close quote. This Pope, says Martin, is in a struggle who will, quote, who will hold and wield the dual power of authority and control over each of us as individuals and over all of us together as a community, over the entire 6 billion people expected by demographers to inhabit the earth by early in the third millennium. Close quote. Ellen White's words that, quote, it is part of Rome's policy to assume the character that will best accomplish her purposes, close quote, take on an interesting dimension in contrast to this statement by Malachi Martin. He says, John Paul had a certain invaluable immunity from the suspicious and prying eye. That white robe and skullcap, the fisherman's ring on the index finger, the panoply of papal liturgy, the appanage of pontifical life, all mean that rank and file of world leaders, as well as most observers and commentators, would see him almost exclusively as a religious leader. Close quote. Again, Ellen White. She, the papacy, has clothed herself in Christ-like garments. Malachi Martin. John Paul's rock-bound certitude, deriving from his Catholic faith and from his personal endowment as a sole vicar of God among men, is that any human effort that is not ultimately based on the moral and religious and teachings of Christ must fail. Close quote. Again, Ellen White. Rome is aiming to reestablish her power, to recover her lost supremacy. She is silently growing in power. Her doctrines are exerting their influence in legislative halls, in the churches, and in the hearts of men. Stealthily and unsuspectedly, she is strengthening her forces to further her own end. Here, again, Malachi Martin says that John Paul, quote, planned to endow his papacy with an international profile and, as pope, move around among world leaders and nations, vindicating a position for himself as special leader among leaders, because in that competition, he plans to emerge the victor. The Roman Church has not relinquished her claim to supremacy, said Ellen White. Wrote Martin, John Paul, as the claimant vicar of Christ, does claim to be the ultimate court of judgments on the society of states as a society. Close quote. Marvelous in her shrewdness and cunning is the Roman Church, said Ellen White. She can read what is to be. She bides her time. Wrote Martin, he is a pope who is waiting. That is the essence of his action. Close quote. Ellen White again. A large class, even those who look upon Romanism with no favor, apprehend little danger from her power and influence. Again, Malachi Martin. No one, individual or corporate body, has formally conceded him the right to act and speak as a religious authority and moral monitor of the Society of Nations. He has assumed the mantle, and no one of consequence really disputes his assumption of it. Close quote. Now, what gives the key to this blood extra punch is that the author is not some over-enthusiastic, date-setting, imminent Sunday law, Seventh-day Adventist trying to cram present-day events into our prophetic scenario. Malachi Martin is a devout Catholic. I mean, he dedicated the book to the Immaculate Heart, a former Jesuit who loves his church and is concerned about its future. You know, his devout Catholicism, of course, gives the book a slant in favor of the Pope and the Roman Church, and a reader has to wonder about all the accuracy of every detail in a 698-page book on current events that doesn't give any references or footnotes. Nevertheless, what's important is that the gist of this book, written by someone probably not acquainted with the intricacies of the Three Angels' message, is that Pope John Paul II is involved in an international struggle to gain the political supremacy that he believes his office entitles him to, and that, so far, as a figure of gargantuan proportions, he has been expending all his energy on this point, and he has been meeting with unparalleled success. Over a century ago, Ellen White in The Great Controversy precisely explained today's trends. Quote, history testifies of her, meaning the papacy's, artful and persistent efforts to insinuate herself in the affairs of nations, close quote. Wrote Catholic historian Francis X. Murphy in 1990, quote, convinced that the church must address political as well as religious issues, John Paul has made over 45 overseas journeys and has maintained contact with as many governments and peoples as possible, insisting that the Holy See is inimical to no nation or people. Close quote. Again, Ellen White. The Roman Church now presents a fair front to the world, covering with apologies her record of horrible cruelties. Close quote. On the World Day of Peace, January 1, 1991, John Paul delivered a message on religious liberty that sounded better than Thomas Jefferson. Quote, it is essential, he said, that the right to express one's own religious convictions publicly and in all domains of civil life be ensured if humans are to live together in peace. No human authority has the right to interfere with a person's conscience. Truth imposes itself solely by the force of its own truth. Close quote. Then, talking about persecution, the Pope said, quote, as for religious intolerance, it cannot be denied that, despite the firm teaching of the Catholic Church, according to which no one ought to be compelled to believe, throughout the centuries conflicts have occurred between Christians and members of other religions. This was formally acknowledged by the Second Vatican Council, which stated that, in the life of the people of God, as it has made its way through the vicissitudes of human history, there have at times appeared ways of acting which were less in accord with the ways of the gospel. On his first visit to Czechoslovakia, the Pope called for, quote, a common European home from the Atlantic to the Urals, and he also expressed confidence that, quote, Europe will fully restore those human and Christian values which made its history glorious and enabled it to have a beneficial influence on other countries of the world. At the end of the 1991, he gathered for the first time in history all Roman Catholic bishops of both Eastern and Western Europe in an attempt to fulfill his vision, the re-Christianation of the Western countries. During a four-day symposium in Rome, the Pope said that a rediscovery, quote, of Christian roots is a key to a united Europe. Of course, by Christian roots and Christian values, he means Roman Catholic roots and Roman Catholic values. And by re-Christianization, he means reestablishment of Catholic dominion. This world, John Paul told Czechoslovaks, must be conquered. It will be, even if not everyone cooperates. Malachi Martin wrote in The Keys of This Blood that certain religions have, quote, a deeply rooted opposition amounting to a nourished enmity for all that John Paul represents as a churchman and a geopolitician. Among them, he wrote, are, quote, Seventh-day Adventists. Martin makes an interesting statement about these opposition groups. John Paul looks upon them, he said, with special solicitude, but he knows that as they now stand, their future lies down one of two pathways. Either they will remain lodged in their historical crevices, holding on to their traditions, or, as some of them have shown a willingness to do, they will decide to accept some form of merger with the various tides advancing upon their positions. Beyond that, any satisfactory relief of their pathos must await near-wide future historical events of worldwide magnitude. Martin doesn't mention what those events of worldwide magnitude will be, nor how those who insist upon remaining lodged, quote, in their historical crevices, the seventh-day Sabbath, will fare. He doesn't need to. We already know. As the Sabbath, Ellen White wrote in Great Controversy, has become the special point of controversy throughout Christendom, and the religious and secular authorities have combined to enforce the observance of Sunday, the persistent refusal of a small minority lodged in their historical crevices to yield to popular demand will make them objects of universal execration. It will be urged that the few who stand in opposition to an institution of the church and a law of the state ought not to be tolerated, that it is better for them to suffer than for the whole nations to be thrown into confusion and lawlessness. Close quote. Malachi Martin, it has always been an essential practice for Rome to make decisions on the premise that the good of all the geo-community must take preference over all local advantages. Interpassional politics might be driven and regulated according to the benefits to be derived by certain groups or nations at the cost of others. Close quote. What might that cost be? And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak, and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Revelation 13:5. Apparently the Pope, whichever one he is, will have all the divisions he needs.